Welcome to A Kenyan's Experience, a podcast for Kenyans by Kenyans. In this podcast, we use real, raw, and personal journeys to provide you with the knowledge and the power to demystify, simplify, and make better decisions about your academic and professional future. They say experience is the best teacher. Well, here you'll hear about the experiences of Kenyan nationals who've navigated the academic and professional worlds, both locally in Kenya and in the diaspora. This podcast is relevant for everyone at any point in their academic or career path, from high schoolers to university students to industry professionals, and even those looking to pivot later in their careers. Here at The Kenyan's Experience, we ask the questions you wish you had answers to before you started your academic or professional journey, before you made that life-changing big decision. And we normalize making bold decisions for you. So tune in for a once-weekly episode that will leave you inspired, challenged, and laughing as Kenyans tell their stories here on A Kenyan's Experience.
Hello, hello. Welcome to season 4 of A Kenyan's Experience. Hello, guys. My name is Cynthia. I'm one of your hosts, and I'm joined by the lovely Gathoni. Say hello.
Hey, guys. Also, like, I can't believe we're in season 4. Like,
I know.
We just started the other day.
I know. It's exciting. I still get nervous, though, but I feel like I've gotten a little bit more comfortable, if that makes sense. I don't know how you feel.
Yeah, absolutely the same.
Yeah. So today we're joined with a very old friend of mine. I'll let him introduce himself because he's got a lot to say. And we're very excited to kick off season 4 with him. And we're very excited to be back, guys. Thank you so much for listening to our old episodes. We'll be posting once weekly to remind you of episodes to listen to. We already started this past week. If you haven't, we ended season 3 on a banger with MDQ on our podcast. We're still shocked, guys. We're still shocked. And yeah, you guys have just been amazing. So keep listening, keep supporting, and keep sharing. So without further ado, we'll start off. So Julio, what is your story and who are you?
Thank you very much for having me. So as Cynthia mentioned, very, very old friends. My name is Julio Mkok. And how do I introduce myself? Young, upcoming, bright lawyer and future politician. But before I start explaining myself, I wanna say that I'm very disappointed. This is only season 4, and I'm only being invited now. So there's been a whole 4 seasons without me. So, but we still continue. We still continue. Still push on. Thank you for having me, and I look forward to the rest of the questions.
Perfect. Well, we're sorry that it's only season 4. but we've been, you know, we're going through, you know, our contact list, and yeah, I mean, we'll get to why I came across you again. I mean, it's been so long. So Julio and I know each other from, I want to say, when you were in Strathmore, and then you had, was it called Black Rock, the rugby games?
Are we aging ourselves?
Shoshos and Gukas already.
I don't know, there's Black Rock still.
But yeah, you're right. I want to believe so, because I do know rugby hasn't died yet in the fraternity of the sport. So I believe it's been there for over 50 years, like back in the day during colonialism. So I believe, yeah, definitely it's still going on. And it's been, what, maybe 10, 15 years since then? So I'd say it's been a minute. It's been a minute.
Okay, no, not that old.
Is that a bit long?
No.
Since 2012. Okay, let's count. Since 2012. Okay, 2012 to 2022. Okay, 10 years. 11 years.
Yeah. Let's just say 15.
Oh, gosh.
So Julio, who I know you already introduced yourself, but tell us a little bit more. So I know we've already covered that, you know, Black Rock's been going on for a very long time. And as you said, you've been playing rugby for ages. Do you still play rugby, actually?
So I don't play rugby anymore. I stopped it in uni. considering my degree, I couldn't balance both of them. Fair. Had to choose. My parents kept telling me, are you going there for the degree or are you going there for the sports? So unfortunately, my priorities had to be realigned.
Fair enough. But how do you think, how would you say that rugby has shaped the person you've become today? Like, it sounds like it still was a cornerstone of your life, even when you went into union. It was only that push, sort of that shove that caused you to let go of it.
Yeah, definitely. I'd say after family, of course, rugby has definitely taken a very important stand in my life in terms of shaping my character. For example, some of the attributes that I can come from the top of my head is rugby has taught me how to work effectively in a team, the aspect of hard work, resilience, because I remember we had this training where we had to run 40 minutes nonstop. I remember I came into high school healthy as one can be, and I left very, very toned and very fit just because of all these 40-minute runs. And friendships, some of the friendships I formed on the rugby pitch and the rugby team are still some of my friends up to today. And definitely it helped me to deal with failure much better. Show you that it's not the end of the road. What matters is how many times you dust yourself up and continue and go back for your goal once again. So yeah, it definitely helped me shape my character and who I am to be today.
Nice. I feel like I can definitely relate. When you're talking about early mornings, runs, commitment, I was like, yeah, I can relate. Because I swam competitively for 8 years. So I'm really like, yep. Early mornings, late nights, balancing, you know, training and school, your friends. And even the failure, I never really thought about it before, but now that you said it, because you don't always win, but it's taught, you find yourself being taught how to deal with those losses that you then take on to, you know, the rest of your life.
I mean, I think that's a good point, because actually, Gathoni, you swam, like obviously you swam for Kenya at an international level, but also you swam as an individual, whereas with Julio, you only played in a team. And so just asking the both of you, how do you think that sort of differed? So for you, Gathoni, when you came from, you know, you're swimming as individuals, Gathoni, for you, and then there's a swimming for Kenya. How did you sort of get into that mindset as an individual and then thinking about failure as well?
I think, you know, sometimes you learn that you have good days and bad days like everyone else. And it sucks in the moment, and it's hard to realize in the moment, because there are times where you've trained, you're like, you know, I'm at my peak and I'll be able to beat my time, I'll be able to beat this next person, and then it just doesn't happen. And so in the moment, you're beating yourself. You're like, what did I do wrong? I did everything right and I didn't make it. Do I suck? Am I not good? And then you talk to other people as well. And then you also I used to just sit in my corner and just think about what has happened. But I think over time, you just realize that it's part of life. And just because you train doesn't mean the next person hasn't trained just as hard. Or just because, you know, you've done your best doesn't mean you'll get the results you wanted. So I think that's just how I take it. It's part of life.
And did you find that you had to have different mentalities as Gathoni, the individual, and then Gathoni as part of a team?
The team, yeah. So when you're part of a team, you definitely, especially if you're the one who has let the team down, you know, it's... That one you just leave. That one you just leave the area, Kabisa. You don't go to a corner. It hurts a lot more when you failed as part of a team. But then I think what I also realized is your team also understands. So if you have a good team where they're like, you know what, no, it's not your fault, or it's not on you, it's a collective team effort. So, you know, the team failure is each of our failures, or each of our failures is a team failure. So I think if you have a team that's supportive and understanding in that way, it definitely makes it a little bit easier. And these are people that you've trained with for years, if not months or days. So you have that understanding amongst yourselves.
Right. And Julio, would you agree with that sentiment as well? Or was it slightly different for you?
No, 100%. Like, I understand the aspect where it's different from when you're participating as an individual, mm-hmm. as contrast to when you're doing it as a team. Because as an individual, you know, you can deal with the disappointment and failure. But I believe personally, if I let down someone else, that's a whole other different feeling. So mm-hmm. me playing in a team and I let down my teammates, it definitely had a big toll on me. And I mm-hmm. found myself working harder to be able to close the gap that I created by letting down my other teammates, where it's working more harder as compared to if it was just me who worked by myself individually.
And how did you find yourself playing rugby in the first place, actually? Was it when you joined Strath?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yes, actually, when I got to Strathmore, I was very, very healthy, as one can
you keep
be,
saying
you know?
This. Very healthy.
Is this the healthy for when your grandparents tell you you're healthy?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then you know when your aunties come to visit at home and then they're always pinching your cheeks. You know, that kind of
got it.
That kind of healthy. So coming off from like being in an all boys school, you mm-hmm. know, there was nothing much else to do in Strathmore. It was either you play rugby or you're not cool, or you mm-hmm. don't play rugby and you're doing academics. It was like that kind of toxic environment. Like, mm-hmm. what are you doing? Like, mm-hmm. other than academics, are you involved in any extracurricular activity? And considering my healthy size, rugby was something that was very heavily suggested. And then one training led to another, and found myself even, actually, when I went to uni, I actually got scholarship for going to play for rugby.
Wow.
So, yeah, I think it definitely helped me in the long run.
That's really cool. I think you're the first person I've heard who's gotten a scholarship to play rugby, like, in uni. That's really cool.
Yeah, but not 100%, just for the record. It was just like a 15%
That's still discount. Better than nothing.
You know how those yeah. unis are just so selfish.
Yeah. But that's really cool.
But yeah, that's
so as you were playing rugby, did you ever see it as a career option, or was it just for fun and for, you know, exercise?
No. Actually, I personally, I really wanted to go into rugby as a career.
Yeah.
But when you grow in a household with strict Christian Catholic parents, very traditional, mm-hmm. Sport is not really at the top of their agenda for their children when it comes to career choices. I did want to pursue it further, mm-hmm. but like I said, there were other bigger plans for me. And unfortunately, that we come from an African household, our decisions don't really take priority when it comes to decisions affecting our lives or careers.
Yeah. Oh, I think we definitely understand that on this podcast. It's a conversation every single time we have. It's like, so how did your parents stop you from pursuing your dreams today?
Mine was pretty straightforward. It was just that one for like, okay, so you come from X family, you have to do X. You know, mm-hmm. like that's how it was. No questions, no doubt about it. To the point where I was even asked, okay, if you want to do this, you have to fund it and take care of it by yourself. And I'm like, okay.
Damn.
It's okay. I'll stay doing X.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we spoke to Lucy Kinuthia on the podcast a couple of episodes ago, and she also went to Strathmore, but as a university student. And it sounds like Strathmore in itself, in general, from the people I've spoken to, you know, just from its reputation, it sounds like the sort of place where like strict, you know, Catholic parents would take you to, because it seems like it has really set morals and standards. And like, obviously there's the toxic side of that, but what would you say have been the positives of being in such a school that, you know, how has it basically made you to the person you've spoken about rugby, but being in that sort of situation? Because I went to a very liberal high school, and I think had I not, you know, come from the family that I've come from with its morals and values, I probably would have ended up a very different person. So how do you think that Strathmore shaped you into the person you are today?
So Strathmore, it was a very, very interesting time in my life. And as Lucy probably highlighted earlier, I want to strongly believe that there are similar aspects with the university and the high school, Strathmore, because they're both run by Opus Dei, which is a Vatican. I don't really know how to describe it, but Opus Dei, you know, to the people who are just in charge of the schools and as a faction of the Catholic fraternity. And so coming from a mixed school, McKinney, to a strict all-male Catholic school was definitely something that needed some adjustment. So it took me some time to settle in. But once I settled in, like Strathmore, nevertheless, we had classes for etiquette. We had classes for respect. We had classes for how to be a gentleman. There was church every day at 11 a.m. So at the same time, when they're building your personality, they're also building your relationship with God. And it also provided like a cutthroat mentality. So students were graded or ranked within quarters. So there was quarter one, quarter two, quarter three. So you are either identified as a quarter two student, or you're identified as a quarter one or a quarter three. So depending on where you were, you had to either work hard to improve or work hard to maintain where you were. So that's why I said it brought a lot of a cutthroat mentality. And father figures, like I come from a family where my parents are not always available. So Strathmore was able to provide that father figure role model on a day-to-day basis more often than I would actually be accustomed to. So it definitely played a big positive role despite all the strictness and all the stereotypes about the Strathmore fraternity. It definitely made me into the gentleman that I am today.
That is so sweet.
And do you find you've been able to create and develop or maintain healthy relationships with your male friends?
I'd like to say yes and okay. No. I believe like the male friends I went through with in high school, who've gone through the same upbringing and the same exposure with me, yes, we still share same sentiments, and we still, like, we're still friends up to now. We still maintain a healthy relationship. But I believe I maintain a more stronger, healthier relationship and less toxic relationship with my friends, male friends who have had the privilege or the exposure to probably study abroad or be exposed to different types of environments. I'll give you a classic example. For example, when it comes to mental health, my male friends who have been brought up in the traditional sense of within, like just being brought up in a traditional setting, you don't have the same perception or the same you don't look at mental health the same as compared to someone who's been exposed to, say, for example, myself, been exposed to Bristol. Like when I went to Bristol, I never knew anything about mental health. I never regarded it. Mental health did not exist to me because I haven't been brought up in an environment that recognizes mental health. So when I go back to my friends who haven't had that exposure, we don't really have those talks which address mental health or how you're doing on a day-to-day basis. But when I talk to people who studied abroad with me or who had equal exposure, I'm able to be more open with them, more, you know, more myself with regards to mental health. That's just a classic example. So yeah, I'd say that I still maintain healthy relationships, but there are others which are more healthier than others, depending on the exposure.
And what was your first experience or exposure with mental health? Was that, if you don't mind me asking, was that from a personal perspective, or was that because I remember as well when I first went to uni in 2014 in London, I had the same experience. I was like, what is this mental health that people keep talking about? I'm like, I don't know. It's like you hear about it. You've watched television shows. You've watched movies. It's not like it's new, but it's like it's not in your face like that and something that you have to reckon with personally. Whereas like, and I don't know if it's because we're international students who've come from, you know, Kenya, and therefore we've gone abroad, and therefore, you know, you deal with isolation and anxiety, and there's so many more obstacles for you from a social perspective. perspective than, you know, your your colleagues who are from the UK. But I think for me, I was just like, eh, what is this depression? Like, what is this anxiety? I was like, you know, so for you, was it similar? Was it sort of, for me, it was a combination of both of my own mental health, but at the same time, it's like, it, the fact being so out there in social media and, you know, in the newspapers and everything. What was it like for you?
So mine was definitely a culture shock. I was like, so we had like these round tables, you know, when you arrive there and you're put in these student accommodations, guys are getting to know each other, whatnot. And they're always like, oh, don't stay in your rooms too long. You can get depressed, you know, worry about your mental health. So everyone was there nodding their head, you know, kind of like how you're doing right now, you know, nodding your head, agreeing. And I'm there looking around like, okay. So in my head at that time, my mentality was, if you're depressed in your room and you worried about your mental health, go out and be active about it. Mm-hmm. So they were like, oh, so you don't recognize, so I was like, I don't recognize the existence of mental health issues unless it's brought to you by yourself. Mm-hmm. But their counter argument was that it's not brought to you by yourself, but it's brought to you by the environment and who, how you are outside. So my argument was always that you have control on your environment. Their argument was you don't have control over your environment. So it did definitely take some time to adjust towards the mental health perspectives where I was, considering that mental health was never brought to me as a topic when I was in Kenya, not once. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because as males brought up in traditional setting, we're shown that showcasing emotions is a sign of weakness. Mm-hmm. I've never seen my dad showing emotions. I can't remember the last time my dad even like was, give me a hug. You know, it was all those ones for like, hey, how you doing, big man? You're right? Yeah, I'm Gucci. You good? Yeah. Life goes on. So yeah, there was never always that emotional connection. And then I go to an environment and they're like, yo, worry about your mental health, worry about you're being depressed and you can't do anything about it. Let's do activities to prop it up. To me, I always saw that as a waste of time and resources. And it really took a lot for me to change that perspective and be the person that I am today, aware about the issues of mental health.
And so when you talk to your friends who, you know, you said the ones who, you know, didn't have the opportunity to go abroad, maybe they chose not to, do you then have to pick and choose the sort of conversations you have with them? You sort of touched on having to, you know, you feel more yourself with people who've gone abroad, probably because, you know, you share lots of experiences together and you can be, you know, it's more relatable, those conversations. But do you often feel like you have to pick and choose your conversations? I ask because I think for me, it's, you know, going back to like, you know, my dad, for example, it's like I sort of have to have like a strong face. And I think it's only literally within the past 5 years that my dad has started to recognize mental health as something that actually exists. And I think that's just, you know, the way that they've been raised. But have you then have to have different conversations with people? And as someone who's seeking to, if you guys don't know, who will you lift this out in his introduction? As someone who's seeking to run for government in 2032, do you think that that's something that you're going to have to work on in terms of bringing that to the people in Nairobi, the young people?
Definitely, it's something that I can start working on, but it's not something that I can successfully like manage to completely turn the tide, considering that, as mentioned earlier, our society doesn't recognize it. So we're trying to bring in an aspect that is not accustomed to people before. You know, introducing something new in an already established society is quite difficult. Change is not inevitable. Change is met with a lot of resistance. So I would say, yeah, a lot of pushback. Mm-hmm. So I would say, yeah, I definitely pick and choose my conversations with the type of people I am talking to. Because if I talk mental health with one group of people, they'll be like, hey, something is wrong with Julio. You really need to check up on the guy. And then when you talk to other people with regards to mental health, they're like, oh, right, you know, I've been really wanting to talk to about this, but nobody has actually even addressed it with me. So like I said, yeah, you definitely have to pick and choose your conversations. You just don't go rambling out, because at the end of the day, one cohort will think you're commercially aware or, you know, physically aware. The other half will think you're going bonkers. Mm-hmm. So it's, I think it's the aspect of just finding balance.
That's so true. do you think, I mean, it's a shame, to be honest, because it is such an important conversation to have, because when you think about the things that we go through as human beings, if you look at society today as well, like everything, there are lots of consequences with not dealing and having conversations about our mental health. And I could go and ramble about mm-hmm. this forever, but this is something that I deal with every day, you know, at the doorstep of the hospital. Like a lot of people, the choices that they make are just based on the fact that they've not dealt with their mental health, or their mental health is, you know, it's mm-hmm. taking a toll on them. And this is in a society where we do talk about mental health and it is recognized, and there is less stigma. There still is stigma towards it, and still we're dealing with the consequences. So you can only imagine what it's like, you know, back home. And so it would be amazing to have someone like you sort of like pushing the envelope for us to have those conversations.
100%. I agree. I just hope that you guys will back me and not just watch me from the sidelines.
Yeah. You have our vote.
Yeah. So let's talk about a bit. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Cynthia.
No, go ahead. You take it.
Oh, okay, cool. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about your uni experience. You mentioned that, you know, the conversations of mental health was like culture shock. Was there anything else that you experienced that you thought was like culture shock as well?
The very weird things, actually, if I can go on mm-hmm. and on about this. So the one thing that really stood out for me was the fact that, I don't know if I can say, but European children are really close to their families, very, very close to their families. Like, they would do anything and everything with their parents. Like, I found that weird, but I also found that very, like, heartwarming. I was like, damn, this mm-hmm. is how... like how things can be, not should, okay, should be, but can be as well.
Yeah.
Like, sure. I really like the fact that some parents were visiting every weekend. Like, I wouldn't imagine mm-hmm. my parents coming from Kenya even once a month to come and just visit you. Like, that was a big step. They would tell you like 2 months in advance. Parents would come, have meals with their parents, you know, have meals with their children. And if, for example, you started dating a girl or a boy, and the parents came the next week, and you've only been dating like 3-4 days, she'd be like, yo, come and have food with my parents. I'm like, yo. I'm like, we've only been for like go-karting dates and a movie. Like, chill.
Like, I'm not even sure you know your last name.
No, I don't know your last name. I always found that so weird, but I was like, this is the relationship of like parents and their children, you know. It's mm-hmm. not, doesn't have to be hands off, it can also be hands on. And then the other thing that surprised me was drinking with your parents. Bruh. Oh my god, that like literally blew my mind.
Them offering like, you a drink,
and I used to deny,
and even like smoking,
yo, I was like, okay, you guys are definitely liberal. Definitely, this is a different dimension from where we've come from. So yeah, small aspects such as those like really hit me hard, and made me see family relationships very different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can't really think about, but there are so many culture shock moments. So if I remember as we progress, I'll definitely mention them. But yeah, that was one thing I remember. I was like, wow, okay. That's very surprising. I don't think any of my parents have met any of the girls I've been with. So that was very interesting.
I mean, I told my dad about someone I was dating last year, and he was like, "I don't know about your boyfriends," and I was like, no. "Okay,
sorry, I tried."
Sorry, I tried. I thought we could be like the Europeans. I guess not.
There's no way. No way. And you know, with us, when you introduce, it's like,
my friend,
this is the person I'm going to marry. Yeah. No. Like, if you introduce the opposite sex to them and you're saying,
right, okay, fair enough.
Yeah. So our parents, they're like, okay, this is the one.
Yeah.
Considering if you've not introduced anyone else, they know like, okay, this is the first one we've been introduced. You are the one that we are taking to the altar. Mm-hmm. That's how our tradition is. But that's completely different when you go abroad. Yeah. So I found that dynamic very interesting.
Yeah. And until you've declared they're your friend, they can be a friend for the next 15 years.
That is very true.
Oh gosh, it's so funny. Like, there's a time we went to one of my cousin's houses, and my cousin came with his friend. And you know, at functions, you're always told introduce yourself. So he obviously came with her, and his mom like texted him and was like, "Ati, introduce her as your special friend." I said,
"Wow, special,
cheeky,
special cheeky, friend, cheeky. Yeah." So it's very interesting how, like, they know, but they just don't want to. They don't want to know.
Acknowledge, exactly, yeah. There's this whole thing of one eye closed, one eye open with African parents. Yeah. It's like they know what you're doing when you're not with them. But then when you start doing it when you're around them, they're like, they start acting shocked and aghast. And it's like, you know, I was out partying when I was in the UK. Why is it all of a sudden a shock when I'm doing it in Nairobi?
Exactly.
As in, I know. Double standards. So, this is wild.
Sorry. So yeah, like I found before I went to study abroad, my parents used to give me this silly, I'll be home by midnight, you know, like, make, where are you going? They always had all these questions. And then spending like 7 years out and coming back, like, we don't have that conversation. It's weird. So they're like, they can't ask you where have you been? Where are you going? Where have you been? What are you doing? I'm like, so for the other 7, 5 years, you never asked. How are you going to start asking now? So I think it's a big switch. Mm-hmm. It's a huge switch that they have to get used to. That has to be done.
I would always be told, that's because we know what it's like in Kenya. But you should trust me.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, anyway, being a parent is a whole other ballgame.
Full-time job.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, Julio, going back to uni, we've really digressed here. Going back to uni, before you even got to uni, between completion of your KCSEs, you sort of took 2-3 years, you know, sort of like, I wouldn't say a break, but you were doing something for 2 to 3 years before you started foundation at Bristol. What was that like for you? Yes. And was that important for you to figure out what it is that you wanted? Was going to Bristol or going to university abroad always in the back of your mind as you're completing KCSEs, or was it something that came to fruition during those 2-3 years?
It's a very interesting question, actually. Yeah, I know a lot of people think I took a break. I never took a break, actually. Bristol was never part of the plan, never. I had no intention of studying abroad. As Cynthia humbly suggested at the beginning, I do have strong political ambitions. So studying abroad was never part of the picture. I was always told, like, if you want to be successful politically, you need to do your undergrad, your master's in Kenya, so that you could build your connects in Kenya. So in the 2-year break, I finished high school in 2013. And then in 2014, bang, January, I went to Strathmore University to do the ICDL program, which took about 3 to 4 months. And then after that, I did an internship at a law firm. It's called Rauter, Thiambo and Co-Advocates, like from June to August. And then funny enough, when it came to September, I applied for Strathmore Law School. And this is a funny story. Actually, Strathmore Law School rejected my ass. So wasn't accepted to go into Strathmore. I know, right? So apparently my... how I was in high school wasn't the ideal way of how the University of Strathmore students behave. So I was like, okay, cool. So I went to Nairobi. I applied for Nairobi UN, Nairobi University of Nairobi. I got in, stayed there I did my first year. Then I was going to my second year, and then was slapped with this. So that time, the University of Nairobi, there were a lot of strikes. There were a lot of mismanagement of funds. And then there was a lot of overpopulation. So University of Nairobi had this problem where they only had 3 classrooms. But in 1 year, they would have 3 different cohorts of students. They would have regular students, they'd have the parallel students, then they'd have the evening class students. So how they did it is that they made a system where the first years would go for 9 months. Then you take a break for the next nine months. So in those next 9 months, when you're taking a break, the second year cohort students would be in school. And then the next 9 months, you're out of school. Then the next 9 months is the third year cohort of schools. So you'll find out that the first year students are waiting for two sets of 9 months to go back to school. So in a course that's supposed to take 4 years, it was going to take about 6 or 7 years, like I'm doing medicine. So one day I told my parents and they were like, yeah, just persevere. We all went through that. So one day I came home from school. I'm just there, you know, watching, chilling in the TV room, watching Scandal, you know, enjoying a very good time. And my dad just walks in and he's like, oh, tomorrow you need to go to the British Commission and put in your papers. You're going to study abroad. So I'm like, study abroad where? I'm starting uni in like next month. Mm-hmm. It's like, no. You just talk to your mother. Payments have been made. Make sure tomorrow at 9 a.m. you're with your documents and you take them. And I was like, oh, cool. So I applied for the visa. This whole time, I don't know where I'm going. You know, I don't know if it's Bristol. I don't know if it's Canada. I don't know if it's Australia.
The communication is just so funny.
Zero communication. Like, I was right in the middle of hearing Olivia Pope giving fits, like, you know, the tea and stuff. And bam, I'm moving countries. So I'm like, okay. So I go to there, I do my application, whatnot. And then one day, of course, you know, African parents, zero communication. Mm-hmm. My mom comes down. She's like, oh, make sure you don't go anywhere. It's Friday. Just like you guys didn't let me go out last night. So it's Friday. My mom didn't let me go out. So she's like, oh, we have a friend coming. So this friend happens to be Professor Phoebe Okawa. And Professor Phoebe was a professor at Bristol. But initially, she was a professor at Queen Mary, which she just finished, so she just joined in Bristol. So she came, she sat down, she was basically explaining to us why Bristol is better. So me, this whole time, I don't know what Bristol is, because I don't know what Bristol is.
I don't know what's London. Going on.
Yeah, but I have no idea. So she's gone on and on about, you know, the advantages of the Bristol curriculum, you know, how it's such a great institution. So I'm like, oh, okay. So I'm asked, Julio, do you prefer staying in the city or do you prefer staying in Shags? So, of course, automatically I say the city, you know, because I'm a city boy. So then my mom is like, okay, but Professor Phoebe strongly suggests Bristol. So I'm like, okay, then why did you ask for my opinion? So
that's a rhetorical question. I really don't care what you think.
So yeah, it like three after the visa came out, it was like August, comes to September. Yeah, I'm taken to the airport and my parents are like, okay, so we send money, fees paid, enjoy. So I got on the flight and I went to school. So I get to the airport and someone's holding a placard, University of Bristol. And around me, I'm like the only black kid. The rest are like Asians, Americans. And they're standing like, oh, hi. Get in the bus and shipped to Bristol. The rest is history.
I'm so stressed out for you.
Yeah, that's how I got to go to Bristol. I was never going to go to Bristol. Even my friends in UN, like one day I was in class, the next day I wasn't. And the next day my picture was abroad. Like nobody knew. I never knew. It worked out so fast. Everything happened without my consultation. Everything was just done for me. And fun fact, mm-hmm. I really wanted to do medicine.
Oh, wow.
Then, yeah, I know. And then my dad was like, sorry, we don't have a doctor in the family. It's all law, legal, and you're going to be doing all the family things after we're done. So we strongly suggest that you do law. So I had to change from medicine to law.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's me in a nutshell for my 2 years.
I think I'm still processing. I have so many questions.
As if you are told, tomorrow take your documents, the next day you're meeting somebody, yes, your opinion, they said it's wrong, next thing you know, you're in another country.
Yeah, man, God, dusted, just like that.
Looking back on everything, yeah, as hilarious as it is, do you appreciate the fact that they took that step? I know it would have been nice to be involved, but do you appreciate that they took that step to helping you get abroad?
I believe with everything I've achieved while abroad, yes, I do thank mm-hmm. them. But there's there's no way of knowing what my alternative life would have been if mm-hmm. I would have stayed in Nairobi and finished it off. I mm-hmm. believe that's always going to be a what if moment, you know, mm-hmm. for me. Like, I had no idea how that would have panned out, but considering everything that I've achieved abroad and everything that has built me into the character that I am today, yes, I can appreciate what actions they took then to put me where I am today.
Mm-hmm. Have you talked to them about it? Sorry.
Yeah.
Have you ever talked to African parents about the decisions they've made?
Sometimes I like to push buttons and ask. You never know. Like, the worst thing they can say is, "Why are you asking me dumb questions?" Like,
that's true.
Like, you just have
really
to try.
Really appreciate. I mean, don't, in this household, you do not question. It's yes, sir. Yes, madam.
I mean, I think like, you just have long. To try and ask. Okay, fair enough. It is the case in most households, but I always feel like you just try and ask. At least you'll know for next time whether you can actually ask, but until you try and ask, you'll know.
That's a very good point. I think I'll try mm-hmm. it when I've started my own family. Have everything financially secure, you know, legally secure. Everything is mine. You know, I'm independent. Then I can ask those questions. So I would definitely take your advice on for recommendations.
Just not now.
No. We're too much in a hurry. Let's not push buttons.
That's true. I think that story really comes as a surprise to me, Julio, because I mean, so we have a mutual friend, was my ex, Ted, and Ted went to university in Bristol, different university. And I just remember one day you just appeared, Julio, in Bristol, and we were both surprised, like, and like, this makes sense now in hindsight, because you literally, truly just appeared. But it's surprising as well to hear that, because you really hit the ground running as an individual, as an international student. And this was similar to sort of like what Paul was saying 2-3 episodes back about how when he went to uni abroad, he sort of hit the ground running. But it's even more surprising for you because, unlike Paul, he knew what he was, you know, he had siblings who had been abroad. He sort mm-hmm. of had so many mm-hmm. questions. He'd done the research. But for you, it was just sort of like, boom. It's like, you're in Bristol, yeah. You know, this is, you know, in foundation school. This is your new life. You know, you mentioned already being sort of like one of the few Black people there. So mm-hmm. what was that like for you? What would you say that led you to that moment where you just like, you decided, this is my reality. This is what I need to do. So you can give advice to other people who hopefully do not find themselves in similar situations, but nonetheless, if they want to hit the ground running and sort of like acclimatize to the environment around them.
Okay, yeah. So again, zero research. I had no intention of getting into leadership roles. It's actually a very funny story. So, okay, I left off when I'm in the bus. Now we're heading to Bristol. We get to Bristol and it is freezing. Bruv, I was like, it is cold, cold, mm-hmm. cold. Mm-hmm. So as time progresses, you're given your room. I remember I made my first friend who was an Asian guy. So yeah, we're given our rooms. We go upstairs. September passes. October, hey, I'm seeing there's a heater in my room. And I'm like, this thing is cold. It's not coming on. So one day I go down for because we had catered. So we had like a dining hall. So you go downstairs. So I'm asking my homies, I'm like, so when do they switch on the heating? They're like, oh, the people who switch on the heating are the ones who get elected. So it's like a student committee that is elected. And the president decides when the heating comes on because the heating is managed by the university. So I'm like, okay, so how do you become that president? Then they're like, oh, so there are going to be elections in November. And then you run, you're elected, you form your student committee, and then you set out the agenda and how things should work throughout the year. So I'm like, okay, perfect. Then the girl goes, so there was this white girl called Ella, and she goes that, oh, but there's never been a BME. So when they're trying to call you non-white, they call you BME.
Wow. BME.
So they're like, oh, but there's really? Never been a BME president. So I'm like, what's oh, BME? Is that so? Mm. So I'm like, no, yeah, that's the first thing I asked. So
yeah, what's
no,
BME?
Before BME, BME is new. BME was like for the last 2 years. It used to be BME. Mm. So BME is black and minority ethnic. Yeah. So all the non-whites, like Asians, Africans, South Americans, you know, basically non-white.
Yeah.
So in my accommodation, it was, were only four of us non-whites out of 400. And out of the four, were only two blacks. One was from London. So I was the only black
African.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So this was like, oh, I got all the BME guys, all four of them. And I was like, yo, guys, what do you think about... I know you guys are feeling cold. I know you homies are feeling cold. So me, yeah, personally, I am suffering. I cannot be going to bed with my sleep socks. I don't sleep with socks. Now I'm sleeping with socks. I'm sleeping with a hoodie and gloves. It doesn't make sense. You know, it doesn't make sense. So they're like, yeah, we feel you. Because I mean, I was on top floor. You know how cold top floor is?
Yeah.
So they're like, yeah, yeah, man, imagine we'll back you. So yeah, I found my little BME group gang, got people on my floor. You know, you gotta get some help. And yeah, I ran for the posts. And then, yeah, I won. Actually, everyone was everyone was looking for that Obama era. You know, we had just come from that Obama time era. Yeah. Okay, so like young my poster king. Was like, "Yes, we can." You know, like I really embodied the Obama thing, and guys loved it. So yeah, I got elected, and I was able to switch on the heating 1 week being in office. So yeah, that's how I got involved. Zero research, zero everything. Then I finished my foundation year and started my undergrad. But how I acclimatized, to go back to your question, is definitely get involved with societies, clubs, and sports. Mm-hmm. I believe like building a community, once you find a community of friends around you, they would really help you to get through your day to day. Like for me, it was like, obviously, rugby. So the sports team, I met a lot of... actually, this is my first experience meeting legacy children. Have you guys come across legacy kids before?
I actually haven't, but I know
not
the term.
Really, no.
So legacy kids are the kids, like if you go to the library, it's named like Wales Library.
Yeah.
Or if you go somewhere, you know, it's their names.
Yeah.
So those are families that have literally built the school. Generations of generations have gone to that school. So... being friends with those types of people really helped me to settle into the university life, really helped me to build a sense of community, helped me actually for a while. I didn't really miss home until like maybe my second year, just because of having friends and people you could talk to, you know, building a community. So definitely join a society, join a club, join a sport, any extracurricular activity.
Julio, I'm loving this podcast episode. It is. I'm just getting shocked.
Like, thank you. Thank you so much.
It literally went from Naskia Baridi to let's become president so I can put on the heating.
Imagine.
Like 2 months. You really can't make that up. That's amazing. Just going back to sort of for other people who are listening who aren't, you may be considering going abroad and they've gone to a Kenyan high school, so they haven't done A levels or O levels. What is a foundation for them, and how can they understand the importance of that into going abroad?
Okay, so systems abroad are very different from systems in Kenya. So in Kenya, in high school, we only do O levels, unless you go to Strathmore, unless you go to St. Mary's and you know you do IB, or you go somewhere else and do IB Hillcrest, which is like international ba something. I can't really mention it. But it's IB. Yeah, that one, baccalaureate. So unless you do the IB, so when you want to study abroad, they'll want your A levels. But if you don't want to do the A-level 2 years, I believe Brookhouse also offers a IFY, which is International Foundation Year, where you have to do the equivalent of the A-level but condensed all into like 9 months or 1 year
yeah.
before you can actually join the undergrad. So it's kind of similar to the American system where you have to do pre-med or pre-law. So it's the same system where you have to do a foundation before you join the undergrad, which is compulsory for most universities if you haven't done the A-levels. But if you've done A-levels and IB, you go straight into undergrad.
Do you think that that was useful for you in terms of getting used to the system and giving you that extra year to be on the same level as them? Or so would it be something that you recommend to people to do if you had the opportunity to do it sort of like in Kenya as opposed to abroad? Do you think it would be better to do it? Because you could, I know friends who've, you know, they did KCSEs and they did the foundation year in Brookhouse and then they went abroad. But then there's you who's done the foundation year abroad in the university that you set out, that you were going to be in for your degree. Do you think that opportunity to have that extra year abroad is better? I mean, obviously for you, you sort of didn't have a choice anyways, but in hindsight, what do you think would have been the better option? To do that in Brookhouse or to just go straight into the university and sort of, you sort of get used to the environment and you sort of just have this sort of like year you can chill before starting uni?
I think it's very useless. Okay, the program I went to was very useless. God, in Bristol, it was the most... I've never wasted time in an institution like that. Like, the things they were teaching us was English, paragraphs, like pronunciation. Like, I was in a class... I think the foundation program in Bristol is aimed at people who don't speak English as their first language. Like, children from Asia... Yeah, Chinese, you know, like people who don't speak English as your first language. Like I remember we were there analyzing Beyonce's song. I can't remember the song, but we're analyzing the song and how many commas, what expressions has she used. Like, it was so useless. Out of the three units I did, maybe the only interesting one was British Constitutional History. And the British Constitutional History, considering I had done 2 years of 1 year of law school already, University of Nairobi, and being Commonwealth jurisdictions, it was basically revision for myself. So going back to your question, I definitely would recommend doing the IFA program in Kenya because I believe it's much more competitive and more full of content as compared to the university's own tailored foundation program. 100%. It was very useless, actually, now that I think about it. It was actually a waste of time. And the only reason I did it is because, unfortunately, not to bad name the University of Nairobi, but at the time when I had finished my first year, there was an option to transfer my credits. So the University of Bristol acknowledged that I had done the first year of Nairobi. And they said, oh, you can transfer your credits. Just ask your university to send us their accreditation license and we'll transfer the credit. Kenya being Kenya, the University of Nairobi being University of Nairobi, their accreditation had expired. And then they were like, oh, you have to wait until the next year when we can renew it and then we'll be able to transfer your credits. So I was like, So now I have to wait another year. So my parents were like, you know what? Forget about it. You just go do your foundation and just start again. So my friends were going into second year and I was going 2 years behind to do foundation. So I had to do foundation, useless year, and then I go into my undergrad year. So that's the only reason I did foundation. If everything was going to go to as planned, I would have never done foundation.
And how did you deal with that? I mean, the fact that you rightly had done a whole year of law school only to then go basically back into not even high school, basically. How did you deal with that?
First of all, I was like 21, 22. So these guys are telling me I'm going to foundation with 18-year-olds, 17-year-olds, you know, guys who have not even got age. So like, I'm thinking that, so I'm going to be the mbamba for the class. Like, what the hell? Like, guys are just going to look at me so weirdly, you know, like, who's this old geezer in the classroom with us? So I remember, like, that's why I got my tattoo, because I was like, oh, how am I going to make friends? This is going to be an icebreaker. They're like, oh, so you have a tattoo? Because I was like, there's nothing in common to talk to with these guys. Like, I was shitting myself. I was scared. I was like, these guys are like 3-4 years younger than me. They're like, it's like hanging out with your sister 24/7. That's how I viewed it. And it was very difficult. But as time progressed, I got there and I found out, compared, there are people older than me doing these foundation programs. So I felt, So some of my closest friends up today are mostly Arabs, Egyptian, Jordanian, you know, Afghanistan, from Pakistan as well. And most of them were coming to their foundation program as well, who just happened to be older than me. So all that over time started to fade off. And I got used to it and started regarding age as nothing but a number. But I got a few scares when you meet someone and they're like, I'm 18. I'm like, whoa, okay. Or when you go out with someone and they're like, you get stuck at the, you know, when you enter the club and guys look at you, ID, I'm looking at them, bro, I'm 21. Like, what's up with you? What about your friend? Oh, yeah, where's your ID? He's like, I don't have one yet. Hey, you know, those are the times that hits you. You're like, whoa.
Yeah,
it was definitely a culture shock and something that needed something time to get used to.
Wow. I was going to ask about like what the kind of stuff they taught you at in the foundation year, but you answered it and I'm just shocking. Because like my sister worked at uni and she would say like 3 months before the term actually started, they would get the students, it's mostly from China, to the, and they would teach them English. But never did I think like that would be foundation year. And you're paying fees for that.
Yeah.
Like as an English speaking person.
Yeah.
You're paying a lot of fees to be taught where Beyonce put the comma in her song.
Man. And don't forget, before you go there, they make you do the IELTS.
I was gonna say,
did the IELTS, Cynthia?
Did you have to twice?
Yeah.
We seem to even knew how to do it.
Girl, so first when I was so because one of my universities I was applying to, that was so upset. The university, I think it was Queen Mary. So, you know, before you get your results down in August, so one of my universities that I'd applied to, and I got a conditional offer. I think it was like my, I think you had to have two of them. How did it work on UCAS? Essentially, you had your first choice and your second choice, something like that. I don't really remember.
But one
of my choices, essentially, I think it was Queen Mary University, had asked for me to do IELTS. Whereas my other universities had said, like, nah, you're from a Commonwealth country. You've done literally your entire schooling in English. You don't need to. But then just because I wasn't too sure if I was going to meet the grades for King's, I was like, let me just do this IELTS. So I did the IELTS then. Then when I was moving to Newcastle University in Malaysia, having graduated from King's College University in London, having taken a degree in 3 years in English, they had the audacity to ask me to take the IELTS. And I was like, what the fuck? When I applied to Newcastle University for my first degree, sorry, I'm swearing, my first degree, they didn't even ask me for the IELTS. So I was just like, what is this idiocy? Like, it just doesn't make any sense.
That's so odd.
So I had to do it twice.
I am so shocked because I've never done IELTS before.
You're not missing out.
What?
Yeah, I've never.
Okay, I need your lawyer or whatever means that you...
They didn't even ask me. Like, I didn't even think about... I didn't think it was a thing. Because I understand, like, sometimes when people go to, like, the Kenyan system, they do ask them to do IELTS. But if you're able to prove, like, your English is good, then they're, like, fine. But for me, I was, like, I was lucky enough to have gone to British system the whole, like, up to year 13. I'm learning the same way you're teaching your people out there. Like, why are you making me, you know? And also, you're the colonizers. We're speaking your language in our country.
Yeah.
So, but anyways.
Oh, I'll never forget the time I met this guy when I was in London. And I can't even imagine. It still shocks me to this day. Basically, I think he was from Russia or something. Really, he was an older guy. I think I was 18. He must have been, I want to say, in his, like, maybe early 20s, mid-20s. And I think he'd never met a black person before. Like, genuinely, I think he was shocked. And so he was like, oh, so did you learn English in the past, like, 1 month you've been here? I was like, what do you mean? And he was genuinely quite serious. He was, like, quite shocked that I spoke quite good English. And I was just like, no, I've been learning English my whole life. Like, I learned English as a child, you know? And it's just, like, I think there is this, as much as it's for us, like, it's just common sense. It's knowledge. Like, we're from a Commonwealth country. English is the most, you know, widely spoken language in the entire world, maybe not the best, but still. But genuinely, for some people, it is a surprise that if you're not white and you speak English really well, that it genuinely does come as a surprise to them. But yeah, it's still wild. You're lucky because then you don't have to do IELTS. You're not missing out.
Yeah, man. I'm so jealous, actually.
I am going to have to do them at some point, but I haven't yet done them. So now you finished your foundation year, you got into uni, your first year. And your course was what, 3 years?
Yeah, course was 3 years.
How were the rest of the 3 years? Like, how was it? I know at some you had already settled in, but how was the actual learning and, you know, everything?
Well, not going to lie, I think university time was one of my best years of my life. Mm-hmm. Not going to lie, I really had a lot of fun in university, especially those 3 years of undergraduate.
Yeah.
Considering I'd already built my community. Like, it was my first experience of boarding school. I had never been to boarding school. I'd never stayed away from home. I had never had that amount of freedom. Yani, no one is calling me to ask me what time I'm coming home, what I want to eat. Yani, I was free. It was just me, myself, and I.
Mm-hmm.
So the 3 years were interesting, fun, and I'll definitely do it once more again. But the learning, so in uni, the way Bristol does it, they don't spoon feed you. Like, the teacher can come in, give you, like, you're given a whole lot of, you're given a guide. And during that guide, in that guide, it tells you, oh, week one, you need to read this amount of content. Week two, you can read this amount of content. You'll be assessed on this day. So when the lecturer comes, they don't really address the intricacies of the content, but rather just brush over it, which is very different compared to, for example, learning in Kenya, where most of the learning is spoon-fed. So like, for example, my experience in University of Nairobi, you would be given the content to read, but when the lecturer comes to class, they go through the content in a lot of intricate, like, details. Whereas compared to abroad, they would be like, so I hope you read page one. What are the things you picked up from page one? They don't tell you their own stand on the topic. They're really trying to get you to get your own stand on the topic and to get your own understanding. Whether right or wrong, they don't tell you they're right or wrong. They'll definitely, or if they believe that you need to be changed, they'll give you a different perspective to get you to come up with a different answer or look at it from a different angle. So I feel like that was a very different approach to what I was used to, but not in a negative, but it wasn't detrimental.
And did it take some, were you able to immediately, like, how do I want to phrase this? Did you have, like, some time where you struggled to get used to the new way of teaching? Or were you able to just jump in directly into it and be like, okay, I need to use, like, my own head, critical thinking, come up with my own opinion?
No. So I did, my head wasn't, at that time, I didn't know how to critically think.
Right.
I won't lie. It was those ones for, you have content, you cram, you photocopy to the exam. That's how my brain was. Like,
right.
I was the master of photographic memory. Page one had A, B, and C. I put in the exam A, B, and C. You know, pop right. up. So to go back to your question, like, how did it take time for me to adjust? Yes. And what definitely helped me to adjust was, again, my friends. So being born in that education system, they were kind of used to it. So I definitely, like, borrow their notes, you know. We would have, like, little get-togethers where you have study group sessions and, you know, just listening to them, how they interact with the questions and how they study. Definitely, I feel like I learned through observation. It definitely took some time. At first, it was difficult. But like I said, just having the right type of friends around you and the community can help you overcome anything that is put in front of you.
Absolutely. I agree. And do you think that then those were the moments when you sort of were able to, because, sorry, let me rephrase my question. So it sounds like you're able to really find this amazing group of people who became your family, so much so that you didn't feel like you missed your family up until second year, which is massive.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people who I talk to are just like, and I don't think I 100% relate with this because I have a lot of friends who are like, immediately they go abroad. Some of my friends will even get homesick when they're still at home. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. But I was one of the group of people who just, I didn't get homesick very quickly. Like I miss my family, but I didn't get homesick. And it sounds like you were of the, you know, the same sort of thought. But how did you sort of still maintain your own individuality, your own personality, your own Africanness, but then you still have this very strong ties to this community in Bristol? You have a family, you've got a good group of friends, and so you sort of need to be able to have a voice and still be able to make it your own, but at the same time be able to start thinking and speaking the way they did.
Oh, that's a very interesting question. And I think it boils down to how was I able to maintain my true self. So being born in a majority, as a majority, like, you know, you're born as a black man in Kenya as a majority, compared to a black man born, for example, in the UK as a minority. The black man born in a minority tends to embody the values and customs of the environment they are born in. And you have no or minimal regard to where you're originally from. So vis-a-vis, for example, myself, born as a majority with all the customs and traditions that have been instilled with me throughout my growth, going into an environment that, oh, by the way, your views are the minority views. We don't really listen to you here. Made me be like, yo, no, man, that doesn't make sense. Like, even me, I have a voice. What do you mean? And then, you know, the minority guys are looking at you like, yo, this is the UK. We don't really do that. We just, like, stay in our corner, get our degree, and bounce. I'm like, nah, I don't think, like, that's how things should work, you know? So I believe, like, being born as a majority gave me a lot of confidence to be able to speak about the issues that affect people like me. So being able to speak up also helped me maintain my character and personality as a black African man. And also, I believe constant communication with people back home. Like, you know, you're going through that point in the first 2 years where you get FaceTimes from people. That's actually how you know your true friends. You know, when you move away, when you move abroad, the people who call you and keep in contact with you, you know, giving you the mshene, the gossip of the town, what you've missed out on, you know, keeping that constant communication also reminds you constantly that, oh, you're only here for a good time and not for a long time. Like, at the end of the day, I always had it at the back of my mind that I'm only here to get the knowledge and then go back home and make home better with the knowledge that I have used. So having that mindset really helped me to maintain my true African self. Yeah. And then also finding the East African society. So I got to a point where I got a bit bored with people around me. So I was like, oh, I think it's about time that we start hanging out with East Africans. So I went to the SU and I was like, okay, here are 30 signatures. So for you to form a society, I did a cheeky thing. So I think it's good that I can come out now because it's like 3-4 years later. They can't see me. So in Bristol SU, for you to form a society, you need 30 signatures of people who identify with the society, meaning I had to find 30 East African students, which wasn't really plausible in the institution I was in. So I went back to my homies in the rugby team. So I went and I was like, yo, guys, I need signatures, man. So you just hook me up, man. So I'll just put African names. So they're like, so what African names do we use? Give them over there. Wambua, Sibiru, Kamau, threw in a few Indian names there, you know, like Shaz, Chakrabarti, you know, like just a few things here and there. And it came to 33 signatures. Oh, so 33 signatures came into fruit. East African Society was formed. Boom. So the issue with our university was that we only had one African society that was supposed to represent all the African students, which didn't make any sense, because in Asia you had the Asian society, but you had Chinese society, you had the Pakistani, Indian society, like, yeah, you had so many different factions within that. And I was like, it didn't make sense for you to say, in fact, ours was African and Caribbean society.
You had in the Caribbean.
Yes.
We all had that, like, one society.
and it was always Nigerian students. I'm like, nah, come on, man. We can't be talking about fufu every day. Come on, there are so many other things that we can talk about. So I formed the East African Society. And funny enough, the next year, the university increased their intake of East African students. And now, nice. Having already built that foundation of the East African Society, we're able to grow into numbers. And when I left, I think it was about 80 students who had signed up who are actually identified as East African students. So that, I believe, helped me maintain my true connection with back home.
That's so interesting because we were impressive. Literally just talking about this before you came onto the podcast.
Really?
Yeah, because I also started the East African Society at King's as well because we had the same problem. I went into the Afro-Caribbean Society, you know, that taster week that you have where you can go for like a couple of sessions. And I just remember I was so excited, a bit nervous, but I was like, oh, this is going to be nice meeting other Africans. But then like going back to what you said about sort of like being the majority and growing up being the majority, and then you go into this room and you recognize that actually just because I'm African doesn't mean we're going to relate and doesn't mean that we have similar stories. And a majority of the people who recognize as Afro-Caribbean were either Caribbean who had moved over to the UK, so therefore were Black British with a Caribbean descent, or they were Nigerian, again, who had migrated, you know, their parents had come really young and therefore were still Black British with a Nigerian sort of history. And I was just like, this is so different. Like, we're just not the same, but I still feel like I want to relate with you, but this just isn't enough. And I feel like we need to be represented. And even my friends who are, funnily enough, Black British, but were like Somalian, Eritrean, Ethiopian, were just like, nah, fam, we have nothing in common with the African Caribbean society because we're East Africans, you know? So, and I think Adoni as well was saying her sister as well started the East African Society. So it's amazing to hear that we all felt like we needed sort of like belonging in our society, and it clearly is very, very important to people's stories.
Yeah, 100%. I'm glad to be amongst entrepreneurs and starters. So thank you.
I'm not even sure if my sister's uni had an ACS. We can ask her if she ever comes on the podcast, but I'm not sure. Because her uni was mostly white people.
What uni was this? Wait, you muted yourself.
You muted yourself, Kaloni.
Lol, that was a mistake. She was in I was just like laughing. I'm like, why are people not saying anything? Anyways, she was in Loughborough uni.
Yeah, Loughborough was, so it was very white. But yeah, you have an when I left, white. There was an East African Society in Loughborough.
What year was it? In her second year, I think that's when she said she created it. So it must have been 2016, 2017.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah, that's when her and her friends came together and were like, we have to do something.
And so going back to being in leadership, Julio, when did you first recognize that, you know, I mean, it sort of sounds like this has always been something that's been a part of you and who you are as a person. Were you a leader when you were playing rugby in Strathmore? Were you vice captain or captain?
I was vice captain. Of course, there were better leaders than me in the fine institution of Strathmore School. And so, I was not always a leadership guy, I think, because I'm very chatty. People normally tend to pick the chatty guy to be the captain or the vice captain, especially in rugby. So when things turn left, you have the loudest guys always shouting at the ref and being there just to tete for the team's needs. So I wouldn't say I've always wanted to be in a leadership role, but I've always had the intention of being in a leadership role in the future, not in the present. But I feel like it's just always thrown on to me.
So how did you find yourself then in the student union at Bristol?
Okay. So my student union journey. So So, of course, it was the most logical step, you know, doing president of the student halls, first year, second year, third year law rep. And then in my third year, East African Society, then faculty rep for social sciences and law, which was like four schools under me. So I actually started dating a girl. Actually, yeah, this is how it actually came up with the SU. So I started dating this girl towards like my second year, a very influential girl in my life. And then it got to that point where it got to your final year and you're like, okay, so I'm going to go back to Kenya because my life is in Kenya.
Oh no.
So, and she was like, oh, really? And I'm like, yeah, but you can visit. And then she was like, oh, okay. And then one day we're chilling. Like, hey, okay. No worries.
You can visit as my friend.
Visit as my homie, you know. So she was like, oh, okay. So one day we're chilling. I think we're playing Among Us or something. And then the previous, the present before me, just happened. Okay, she wasn't the president. It was one. So our uni was run by seven elected leaders. So there was the president, then you had six other vice presidents under them. So two of the vice presidents were very close with the girl I was dating at the time. So they visited one day for dinner. And then they were talking. And then they were like, oh, elections is coming up. Why don't one of you run? Because she was very heavy with the African Caribbean Society. And then after a lot of deliberations, again, as I mentioned, it's always put on me. They were like, oh, why don't you sign up and try it out? Then I was like, you want me to go and ask for votes from 28,000 people? I'm normally used to about 100, you know, people who I can control, you know, before you can see. It's 28,000. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to put your face out there. I had to do a whole campaign music video. I had a song. Like, it was huge.
Wow.
So I applied. I put in the application. Turned out, of course, surprise, surprise, I was the only black guy out of like eight strong white Tory students. Like, proper, like, how do you do today? Like, would you like a cup of tea? You know, type, like, proper. Then you just have me and my Luo, you know, Luo Kenyan guy just coming through. So, yeah, I put it across. And so you just put in your application, but the SU vets. It's just that nobody is just allowed to vote. So they vet you to see if you're actually being serious so that they don't waste their resources in campaigning for you or putting out your material. So yeah, one thing to led to another, and I was accepted and I ran for the campaign.
Was that a shock for you? Because obviously, I don't know if some people understand, but essentially, if you're part of the student union, that means you graduate and then that's your job now, essentially, after you've left university. Yeah. Was that something, like, how did you have that conversation with your parents and telling them, like, I know I was meant to come home, but actually, nakauku. And obviously, you stayed for quite a number of years, even during COVID.
Bruh, I was cut off. I was cut off financially. My mom and dad were like, Julio, we did not send you there. Because to them, they didn't understand what students' union was. You know, to them, they thought it was like, that what they could equate it to was the Babu Owino and, you know, the UON, SONU, you know, the student of university of Nairobi Union, you know, like the equivalent, you know, how much there's so much fracas and whatnot. To them, to them, that's what I was doing, you know, going to parties every day, because to them, they're like, the SU creates parties for the students, you know, you're partying and stuff. I even getting paid. They didn't believe I was getting paid. So for them to believe I was getting paid, my dad was like, okay, if you're not coming home, I think this is where you start becoming a man. So I was like, okay, what do you mean? Okay. Like, oh, we're not going to be sending you allowance anymore. So I was like, okay, dad, I was elected in March. Yeah. I finish my exams in June and I get sworn in July. So what are you telling me between March and June? So he's like, no, I will provide for you during your studies. But once June finishes exams like this, if you're not coming home, we'll book for you a flight. But if you're not on that flight, you can forget about us supporting you. So in my head, because, you know, elections happen in March, I already knew I had won. So I knew, okay, July is going to be tough because I won't have money, but I'll be paid at the end of July. you know, because of the full-time job. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just had to survive that July. Thank God I had this girl I mentioned before. So she kind of like took care of me that 1 month. And my parents didn't talk to me for a solid, like, until I think Christmas, because now I was asking them, oh, can I come? I'd like to come home for Christmas. So they're like, okay, you can come home for Christmas, but us guys are going to go to Dubai. So you can either come to Dubai or you go home and chill with your shosho in Shags. So I was like, I think I'm just going to stay. So I stayed the 2 Christmases that I was in office. I stayed in the UK. I didn't come back home. Basically, they were against the whole idea until they found, until one day when I was on Sky News, then they were like, oh, okay. So this thing is actually serious. Okay, thanks. So they started talking to me and being unmad.
Mm.
Yeah. So that's the story in the nutshell.
Wow. I mean, it sounds
Two Decembers?
Yeah, go ahead, Gathering.
It feels like it would have been so lonely because it's the coldest time. Like, no one is really around. How are you surviving?
Okay, so the first Christmas, I spent it with the girl's family. As I told you, they're very close to their families, you know, very, very weird thing. The second Christmas was COVID. So people were not allowed to travel. So a lot of international students were not allowed to travel because of the, what did you call that thing where they put you, isolation period. You know, when you came back from,
quarantine.
Yeah, you had to stay in isolation for two weeks or was it 3 weeks? So most students didn't go home that Christmas. So the SU had someone stay and actually like manage the activities during that time, make sure students were okay, you know, be a correspondence between the university and the students. So during that time, I remember when Christmas Day we had like, I had people come over to the house. I made some ugali. So they really liked that. There was some nyama choma. So in my house, even though I was the only black guy and having a black African meal, with Asian students, we still had that sense of community and sense of belonging, so we were able to go through those 2 Christmases. So yeah, it wasn't that lonely, but I kept my mind busy. As much as I'd love to be with my parents at the time, COVID and other circumstances just didn't allow.
I mean, it sounds like you turn any situation into a triumph, Julio, and I think that is a testament to who you are as a person. But going back to what we talked about earlier on about mental health, all jokes aside, how did you really manage during that time? It sounds like you had a really good support system, but I think it says something when you're out here doing amazing things. And I've been in that situation where it's really hard for parents who are back home to really appreciate the things that you're doing that aren't academic. And you're sort of like going what it seems to be in quotes against the grain. How do you deal with that sort of, I want to say, rejection and sort of just being like, I really need you in my corner? But then it also sounds like you had your girlfriend at the time and her family in your corner as well and your friends. But how did you deal with that personally for people who, and I think it's unfortunate to say, will probably still find themselves in that situation in today's age, in whatever thing it might be, in uni, it might be taking a different career path, whatever it is.
It's definitely, don't get me wrong, like there were some hard times, and then it's not like I had the support system 24/7. There were definitely some difficult moments in my life, and then how did I deal with it? There were days where I just sat at home, you know, where you lock yourself up and just go into your own thoughts, you know, really, and just take one day at a time. I didn't really, you know, up to this point, as much as I recognized and I was aware of mental health, I still did not know how to deal with it. I had no idea on how to deal with it. So it was difficult. You just had to take one day at a time, you know, move on with one day at a time, be sure to talk about it. But at the same time, if you're alone, how do you talk about it? How did I get through it? Up to now, I don't know. I can't give you a definite answer. I think I'd just give the toxic masculine answer and just say, push through it. I pushed through it. But is there a better way of doing it? 100%. Is the better way of doing it my way? No. I believe that it's not only enough to have a great support system, it's not only enough to have a great partner, but also to have active ways of dealing with that feeling. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have active ways of dealing with that feeling. I did not. It was always fun and games. It wasn't actually sit down and actually let's deal with it. Being aware of something is not the same as working actively towards it. And I never worked actively towards it. I'm just aware. I'm just super aware about it. I know how it's caused. I know how it can be dealt with, but I've never actually carried that out. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, I don't really have a definite answer to your question. Like, how did I actually deal with it? Because I didn't. I feel like I still have remnants of trauma from those days, because there were days where you would go like almost a month or two without seeing anyone, because there was this period of COVID where, since it's an all whites uni, most students would go back to their homes. It's like working in or studying in Naivasha, and then when shit hits the fan, you come back to Nairobi. So that was the exact same notion. When shit hit the fan in Bristol, people would go back to their families, where we couldn't do that. So as much as I had a good community, I think there was more that could have been done for me to actually tackle it better.
Oof. Damn.
Yeah, those months of COVID, tough for people abroad.
Yeah, very tough. But yeah, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Or leaves you with a really bad coping mechanism. So you came back to Nairobi after like what, half a decade in Bristol, more time than you thought that you were going away.
7 years.
7 years. Yeah. Oh my god. 7 years away. What was that like for you, and what were the decisions that led to you coming back to Nairobi? It sounds like, you know, you had a partner, you had a whole life in Bristol. I personally thought you were going to stay. I was very surprised when you came back. But it sounds like you always knew that you're going to come back, but even though it was extended, that was always the plan.
Yeah, transition to Nairobi. It was weird. I never thought I'd have culture shock. Like,
I was about to ask about that.
Yeah, like, I had mad culture shock. I came back, society was overwhelmed by my piano. I was like, what the hell is this thing people are singing? You know, like, it was so weird. Like, everyone is speaking in different languages.
Right.
And then the infrastructure had changed. The people that I used to know 7 years ago are not the same people who are now, or we just don't share the same interests, or we just don't vibe anymore. The way things operate were different. So yeah, as much as I was born here, coming back, I had the same culture shock I had for the first time when I went to study abroad. I was going to stay. I had 3 job offers from like white collar companies.
Wow.
But like you said, I always knew I had to come back home. I, as much as everything I achieved and exposed to abroad, I always knew I was going to come back home. Like, my passion and my career goals are always to join politics and probably make Kenya a better country as we are today. So my love for politics definitely pushed me to come back to Kenya and live the wonderful life that everyone portrays that it was in Bristol, United Kingdom.
Wow. The 3 offers and you decided to come home, that you're stronger than most.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I had to do KSL. I had to do pre-KSL. Again. Like, gosh. There's so many things I had to do. And I had to do that now because people who I started with, remember, I had to start again, and the people went ahead of me. Now they've been admitted to the bar. They're working for law firms. Like, they're making their guap, their independence. Some have moved out, and here I am. I'm coming back. So, yeah. So I did this abroad. Very great achievements. Amazing achievements. But yeah, bro, you have to go back to school. You have to do KSL. You have to do pre-KSL. So I'd say my love for politics and the need to be admitted to the Kenyan bar to achieve my dreams are some of the main reasons I came back to Kenya.
What was the adjustment like coming back? You know, you're used to your own independence, and then you come back home and have to start answering to people.
Bruh, it's so annoying. You know, like, you know, I go on those benders for like, you leave the house on Friday with your homies, you come back Monday morning. You know, those kind of benders. Mm-hmm. And you come back and you come back to like an intervention. Like, where have you been? What have you been doing? Where have you been sleeping? And you can't explain because you don't remember. You know, like, it's just been on a blender. I can tell you who I was with. I was with X, Y, and Z. But what we did, I think you have to check our Snap memories. Or, you know, like I have no idea, mom and dad. So adjusting to people, like, being all over you and, you know, just checking over your shoulder compared to a life where nobody cared about your whereabouts. Nobody cared what you did, apart probably from your partner or your housemates. Mm-hmm. Other than that, even your housemates were hand off. They would be like, you'd see them in the morning, you see them in the evening, maybe over the weekend if they're not home, if they've not gone home. So coming back home and just being, I want to move out, don't let you. I really want to move out. I want to leave this place. But just waking up and finding food made for you is just a different kind of flex. It's just a different kind of flex. I love it. You know, like, that's the only thing that's stopping me from going, from leaving. But yeah, I don't like the supervision. I don't like the supervision. No.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're lucky we live in a country where it's affordable to get help. So, you know, you could always have somebody who cooks for you.
Where? Oh, here. Oh, yeah.
Definitely. So, I highly recommend moving out. I did it, and I had to move back home, but, you know, I did it. Proud of myself for trying it out.
So what matters is that you tried.
Exactly.
Yeah. But no, I don't think I'd love to move out, but, you know, staying 7 years away from home and then coming back.
Right.
Yeah. Like, this is my second year home. Like, I came back in 2021. So, yeah.
Okay.
It's my second year home. So, it's. I kind of like it, but I also know it's getting boring to the point where I need to go away.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But you need to experience that, because then you're able to identify what it is that's important to you and what isn't. Like, if you were to just move back home, immediately move out, first of all, your parents would be like, this is disrespectful, first of all. And then the other thing, you don't even have the money to look after yourself. You've gone back to school.
Yeah, trust.
And also, like, now you know what is important to you and what matters to you. And you know exactly why you're moving. Because I feel like earlier on, we can be quite, what's the word for it? Quite reactive in terms of, like, I moved back home and now you're on my back. Nini, I just want to move out. But then I feel like when you stick with that difficult emotion, and you're able to straddle that tension, you're just sort of like the tension of, I want to move out, but I'm really enjoying being home and being cooked for and, you know, seeing my folks every day. And then you're able to think, and you're able to mature through that if you're able to hold still.
Yeah.
And now you're at the point where you're just like, okay, if I want to move out, I need to X, Y, and Z. And this is why I want to move out, you know? I think your parents respect you more for it as well.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I feel like my treatment when, you know, those days when you just, in those 7 years, you come and visit, the treatment when you visit is very different from the treatment I have now.
It's like you're a guest then.
Now you're a mwenyeji. Yeah, pretty much.
And so just coming towards the end of our conversation, we definitely will not end without talking about For the Fifth. and if you would allow us, Julio, do you mind telling us what is For the Fifth and why it's important?
Okay, so the Fifth is a series of events that were led by the now current government's campaign team. And the whole main aim and the whole goal of the Fifth series of events is bringing together the youth of the country and being able to share different attributes that you'd like to see in the current leadership of the country, and try to contribute in the choices of creating, you know, successful opportunities for the youth themselves. Because let's face it, Kenyan youth rarely participate in electing their leaders because we see it as a lost cause, or we have no faith in the government, or we have no, we don't regard politics as important to us, mm-hmm. because people who are heavily involved in politics are people who want their rights, certain rights and freedoms and individual opportunities realized. People who don't engage in politics are people who already have most of the privileges and rights that are dear to them. So the whole aim of the event and the series is, regardless of class, regardless of sex and race, as long as you're a youth, we would like you to heavily be involved and contribute in electing our leaders of our country. Basically, that's it in a summarized manner.
And why do you think it's important for this to be something that's integral to the youth right now?
So Kenya's population is 75% of the Kenyan populations are made up of the youth. Mm. So if the youth wanted, and if the youth decided and we came together, we could literally decide who our next leaders would be. We wouldn't have to fall victim to the system, so-called system, or legacy families that have been around politics for years. So it is important because we want to showcase the power that the youth have. I don't think the youth understand what kind of power we have in directing and governing our country. Mm-hmm. And once we realize that power, I believe Kenya can definitely change for the better. Because it's high time that, no offense to our old parents and our old mentors, but it's high time I think we had a change of guard and have a fresh breath of ideas towards the direction the country should take.
100% agree.
Yeah, same here.
Sometimes my parents are like, well, I feel sorry for you guys.
Our fate is sealed.
Yeah, so it really gives, we as the youth need to do something about it.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
How has it been? You said it's a series of events. How has the engagement been like?
Oh, the engagement has been amazing, actually. Okay. So unfortunately, I know I'm gassing it up, but we've had a series of events, but we've only had two. Eh? We only had two. One was off the books. That one was like soft launch. We were told we can't talk about it until like we see how the engagement is with that one first before launching the second one. So when we did the second one, it was amazing. We had like over 200 people come in, all youth. We had it was held at the Western Hotel, just on Langata Road, and we had prize giving. A lot of people won a lot of gifts. There was a lot of quizzes, you know, quizzes that were revolving around politics and the governing of the country, and what youth can benefit from the current government, or if the government at that time was to be government. So yeah, 100%, like things were moving on well. And do we foresee any other future events? Yes, so I have been told once everything is settled down, over though it's 6 months in after they've settled down, no shade, we were going to have more events happening. So yeah, definitely, if any more events happen, you know, any of you are in the country, I'd really like if you could attend and you could see for yourselves.
Absolutely. I mean, it's exciting to hear that someone is finally giving the youth the microphone and asking us what we care about. I think I've never been, like, when I look at, I don't know what it was like for you guys when you're here in the UK. I think it's definitely different now for me now that I'm working, but people around me genuinely seem to care about politics. And I think as a nation, like as a youth, we don't really engage with it. Like my parents, yeah, they watch the news, you know, at 9 p.m., put on the news, stop watching whatever watching on Netflix. It's time for the news, you know, and they properly engage with it. And for me, it's always just been like, why should I care? No one cares about my voice, you know. And I voted for the first time earlier this month, literally last week was the first time I ever voted in my life. As a foreigner, someone cared what I had to say. Yeah. And yeah. I think it's just so empowering to hear that someone in Kenya, you know, the current government included, does care about the youth. And I hope it really continues. And it's exciting to see, because we started off A Kenyan's Experience, a podcast, talking to somebody else who's also interested in running for parliament and then running for government. Yeah. And then to hear you as well, it's just, it's really phenomenal. And I really wish you the best, Julio. And it's very exciting. And definitely when I'm around and if there's an event happening, I will be there.
Definitely. Happy. Thank you so much, guys. I really appreciate it. I think today I'm gonna sleep with a big hearty smile. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I think thank you so much. This has been one of my favorite conversations of the whole podcast.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, because it's
making me all shy and stuff.
Yeah, this has been really fun.
Thank you for having me, definitely. But as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm still very, very disappointed it's only season 4 and I'm being brought in after 4 seasons, considering it's your favorite. Math is not mathing, but...
Apologies.
It's okay. I'll take it on the chin.
But, I mean, it just means that you definitely have to come back. That's all it means.
Yeah 100%. Definitely.
Yeah, thank you so much, guys.
But yeah, as we've come to the end of this podcast, thank you so much, Julio, for being with us, for taking the time to share your incredible stories that I'm sure will make people laugh as much as we have. And just to be, you know, mouth agape the entire time. We wish you the absolute best. And for our listeners, thank you for joining in. Thank you for the love that you've been sharing with us. And let us know what you think about this episode. And definitely make sure to follow Julio on his socials. Julio, what are your socials?
Oh, really? I get a shout out? Okay. So, so my Instagram is Ignatius_MK. And my Twitter handle is Julio Mkok, one word. Actually, yeah, it's Julio Mkok, one word. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Those are the only two. Unless you're on my LinkedIn, but only serious candidates only. It's just the same. It's just Julio Mkok. Thank you.
Follow Julio on his socials, reach out to him, and make sure to look out for the next For the Fifth event. If you haven't already, I think there's a reel on Julio's page where you can sort of get a snapshot of what happened, and we'll share it with you guys as well if there's a next event. But thank you so much for listening. Remember to leave a rating and a review, follow us on Instagram, and follow us on Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. That brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you so much for listening, guys, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Yay!
Bye.
Thank you for tuning into another episode of A Kenyan's Experience. If you found this episode inspiring or even helpful, then please do us a solid and share it with close friends or family, or even just share it to the world. We appreciate you. Hit us up, check out that new feature, the voice notes. Let us know what you think about this episode. We'd love to hear back from you.